Welcome to the Reader's Roundtable edition of Cattlecast with Jessica Trotter, Mari Garza, and Cheryl Lindemann.
Welcome back to the Reader's Roundtable edition of Cattlecast. I'm Jessica Trotter, and I'm joined by Cheryl Lindemann and Mari Garza, and we're your primary selection team here at Cattle. It's October. We're taping this on a downright cold morning after a wet and windy night, which sort of sets the stage for a Halloween and spooky and surreal and all that. And that's kind of the discussion we wanted to have today. We have a collection of, I think, interesting, seasonably creepy, interesting. It's not all horror, but it's just interesting reads that fit the season in their own way. Yeah, definitely.
So I'm going to kick us off with a couple picture books. You know, this time of year is definitely all about planning your costume for trick-or-treating. I've got two titles. The first one is A Costume for Charlie. It's by C.K. Malone. And this is a picture book that features Charlie, a child who's trying hard to come up with a costume for Halloween that honors their identity as both a boy and a girl. In the book, Charlie's shown like kind of hunting through a trunk of, you know, costumes, play costumes, searching for that perfect disguise to go out on. And I have to say that I do not come across many picture books that have bi-gender children as part of the main storyline. So I knew I had to read this. It is illustrated by Alejandra Barajas. And Alejandra's a Mexican painter. And I would say the cover image on the in the book, what's on the cover, it shows Charlie dressed as both Little Red Riding Hood. And they are viewing themselves in a mirror with a reflection of Dracula. That is the most striking image in the book. It was really interesting to read. The author does include an afterword that touches a little bit on bi-gender identity. The other book I have is Scary Stories by Toni Johnston, illustrated by Tomi DiPaola. And this is really an old school book. It dates back to 1978. It was actually published as Four Scary Stories. And in the book, there's like an imp, there's a goblin, there's a scalawag, one of my favorite words. And there's a boy lurking, you know, in the background of the story. And it is definitely a picture book, but it kind of reads like a reader, like an early reader, because there's like little, sort of like chapters, not exactly. But each child has, you know, a version of their story. For me, the best part of this book were the vintage, you know, illustrations by the late Tomi DiPaola. You know, and it was just a really fun read. I could picture kids giggling to this. As is common in picture books, you have a refrain, you know, that's repeated throughout the book. And in this case, the refrain is Zinky Zinky Zoo. And I'll end with the three little things shrieked, grabbed their pointed hats, quickly said Zinky Zinky Zoo, and poof, they were gone. So I hope people pick that up.
How fun. That reminded me of being a little kid and listening to the librarian read a story. Yeah, that's awesome. So I don't know about any of our listeners, but I tend to go in some patterns with my reading. And it seems like in October every year, or late September, I want to read a cozy mystery. And it's a little bit unique for me because I'm a nonfiction selector. I tend to read almost entirely exclusively nonfiction and some kids' books. And so I'm always, every year it happens, you know, it's leaves start to turn, there's mums in the stores, and I want to read a cozy mystery. But I'm a little particular about what I like in a cozy mystery. And so it's always, I'm drawn to them, but I don't always love them as much as I think I will. But I discovered the first in this series last year, or a couple years ago now. And for this podcast, I'm actually talking about number three in a series, but I think these could be standalone books as well. It's called A Killer Sunday by Abby Collette, and it's number three in the Ice Cream Parlor Mystery. And this is a mystery series set in Chagrin Falls, Ohio, and it's just a delightful town, and it has a wonderful cast of characters, including our main protagonist, Ronwyn Cruz. She's the owner of Cruz Creamery, which is an ice cream business that's been in her family for generations. She actually left her corporate job after getting an MBA to come home to her family town to run the the ice cream shop. And this is an ice cream shop where they make homemade ice cream, and she uses the vintage recipes of her grandmother, which is just very, very cool. And she'll make really unique things like kiwi sorbet. She always has a fresh fruit sorbet, and it's not what you think. It's not just raspberry. She'll have yogurt and blueberry pops, like ice cream type pops. So it's just wonderful. Well, she's just launched a new food truck that's an ice cream truck. It's not an ice cream delivery truck. It's more of a food truck that sells ice cream. A little different. She doesn't go down the streets with a song playing. So she is having this truck at the Harvest Time Festival, which is a huge festival in the town for fall. And somebody gets murdered. And this is somebody that is a high school classmate that she never got along with. And they were poisoned. And they looked to be possibly poisoned after they had her ice cream. She doesn't want to be roped into these murders. It's happened two times before, and it's a tiny town. She doesn't know why this keeps happening to her. She really fights it, but of course she gets roped in. She has some fantastic sidekicks, two best friends, Maisie, who's like an acorn show-loving, mystery-loving detective-type friend, and Rhea, who's that really no-nonsense, assertive, slightly aggressive, kind of pushy friend who, you know, works in the medical field and is really no-nonsense. But one of the best parts of this is her own character, the character of Bronwyn or Wyn, and her tight-knit family, who you will grow to love. So it has a lot of setting, a lot of really good character development, and of course the mystery. So highly recommend this one.
Okay, my first one is also not horror. As I said, we're not doing all horror, and actually neither of mine are horror, but it's creepy. In its own way, it's The Book Eaters by Sunya Dean. It's a twisty, gothic feeling kind of. It's a debut fantasy thriller. It's got a lot going on. It features a mother who's just trying to take care of her son who has unique dietary needs. Per the title of the book, she is actually a normal book eater, so she can eat a book and it will sustain her, and she remembers everything in the book. Well, her son, unfortunately, is slightly different in that he consumes minds and keeps everybody's personalities. So it's not as it is as gruesome as it sounds, but it's one of those things. It's an interesting story. You find yourself sort of thinking about who's the monster in this story. Is it the kid? Is it the people after them? Is it the mother who's trying to keep her kid alive no matter what it's required? It's a really interesting story that explores trauma, self-determination, and family. And it's fantasy is so good for looking at some of those really big topics. And it's also just a thrilling kind of twisty story. So it's really great debut. And that's The Book Eaters by Sunya Dean.
Wow. Sounds entirely unique.
It is. It really was. It was very different from anything I'd read.
Yeah. Wow. So I have a young adult title, also perfect for Halloween. It's Dead Flip by Sarah Farazan. And I guess you could say this is a little horror, YA horror, but honestly, I think it read kind of like a Stranger Things episode. I know that's all the rage right now, and everybody loves that sort of stuff. You've got three friends in the story. There's Corey, or Corinne, Maz, and Sam, and they have been best buds since the seventh grade. And this is actually a book that's kind of set in the late 80s, 1987 and 1992. So it kind of alternates chapters between the characters, though Sam really doesn't make an appearance from his point of view until later on. So they're very short chapters, and you get a look back at what happens when a pinball machine enters the life of these three. The pinball machine, known as the Sorcerer, comes with glowing red eyes at the local party store, and Sam somehow is affected by it in such a way that he's got nightmares, And he ends up disappearing during their Halloween trick-or-treating night. So forward future, you've got Maz, who his family is from Iran, and Corey, who is trying to come to terms, maybe not even come to terms as much as like just be honest about her queer identity and wanting to be able to be open with friends, family, etc. So they're going back and forth, and now they used to be best buds, but since Sam has disappeared, they're no longer best buds of the two that are left. But get this, Sam does return, but still as a 12-year-old. It's kind of creepy that way. I really love this book because Farazan, the author, is just really good at coming up with not just snark and sarcasm, but just things that... You know, teens might think about, and depending on where you come from, what your outlook on life or how you view the world, you know, can be really different. There's this line that Sam says, who clearly Sam is the kid who might have the most trouble in life, and that, you know, maybe he's not super wealthy, single parent, you know, parent who left the family, really rough. But he says this line about, you know, there's nothing great about growing up, Maz. And you hear that line a lot when you're a kid, right? Grow up, stop acting like a baby. And, you know, Sam knows there's something hard coming up. So anyway, I think that this is going to appeal especially to me, like a Gen X person, and maybe others. There's a lot of nostalgia in the book, Pee Wee Herman. And something that I really loved, actually, is that the role of parents, like when the kids do naughty things, like, you know, dump punch bowls on someone's carpet, they make the kids go and apologize to the parents. So to the property owners, I should say. I'm like... That's nice to know that parents are out there looking out for their kids, trying to help them develop good manners. So, yeah, I hope you'll read that one.
Awesome. Very cool. I was about that age in 1987, so that really resonates. You know, I think we're starting to see some of those, like, Gen X era books almost being like historical fiction. I think we've talked about that before and had a good laugh about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I guess you could say.
It's like our growing up era has entered that time. Okay, so I'm taking Monsters in a totally different direction into a book that was released this year called The Monster's Bones, The Discovery of T-Rex and How It Shook Our World by David K. Randall. And this is quite the tale. It's one of those narrative nonfiction books that reads in a really exciting way. It's an excellent combination of kind of biography, history, and science, so it can appeal to people who like all those types of nonfiction. And it's the story of two men, Henry Fairfield Osborne, who was a very privileged socialite, who, you know, had a life of luxury, and ended up working at the American Museum of Natural History and really wanted it to succeed. And believe it or not, at the turn of the century, it really wasn't doing very well. People who are more interested in the P.T. Barnum type shows, not so much in minerals and mammal bones and that sort of thing. And then you have the other character from history who I knew nothing about, named Barnum Brown. And Barnum Brown's probably one of the more important paleontologists in history. So it's really the story of these two men who couldn't be more different. And it goes all over. It goes into the West, where everybody is looking for dinosaur bones. I didn't really know that. It was like the gold rush, you know. It's like, I'm gonna go try to find some dinosaur bones. And then it goes into other countries, but it follows the stories and the lives of these two men and really shows how the Museum of Natural History came to finally have success, which really was reliant on something like the large dinosaurs being there, and also about how dinosaurs came into our consciousness, you know, and it was during that period. So this book goes from the late 1800s until World War II and chronicles not just this museum, but it talks about the Carnegie Museum, the Field Museum, and all of these powerful players. You have Rockefeller, Peabody, Marshall Field, and all of the power that really was behind trying to get these expeditions run and then to get the bones. And actually kind of at the end sort of talks about how dinosaur bones have been a commodity. You know, they're a commodity, they're sold now. And sort of the ethics of that. Is that really what needs to be happening with something like dinosaur bones? But that is where we're at now. So just a fascinating read, The Monster's Bones.
All right. And then my next one is, again, sort of, it's a creepy read. It's Our Wives Under the Sea by Julia Armfield. This is actually, it's a novel more bordering on a novella. It's not a long read. It's actually very quick. And it's just a very surreal and interesting look at grief and a marriage. Miri is the wife of a research scientist who goes on a mission, a deep sea mission. They lose contact. They don't know what's going on. But eventually, very late and long past really when anybody should have been able to survive, the submersive comes back up and Leah is alive. But slowly but surely, Miri is sort of thinking her wife did not come back. She's not, there's something physically wrong. She's just, they can't have conversations. Miri is doing her best to kind of support them both. She's calling to make sure that they have medical coverage for whatever is going on, that they can run some tests, do something to maybe get her wife back. And it's just not working. And you get flashbacks from before the expedition and the meeting and that sort of thing. You get flashbacks of, you know, right up to the meeting. Then you have moments of, interspersed, you have moments of Leah's actual experiences as in the submersible, not quite knowing whether this was intended, whatever happened to their ship, whether it was intended by their employers, whether it was not intended. But it's just a very creepy feeling that something's wrong, feeling that something's out there. Kind of other people on the crew not acting right. And you get, but you don't get full on answers necessarily about what's going on as this is happening. But it's just a very surreal and interesting look at the dissolution of that relationship as Leah is physically changing throughout the whole thing. It reminded me a little bit of Guillermo del Toro's book and movie, and I'm blanking on the title, but it was the Oscar-winning story.
Yeah. I'm imagining it right now.
I can see the cover.
Yeah.
Yes. Yep. Nope, it's not going to come, but I will put it in the show notes. You all know what I'm talking about. It had a fish.
That was an amazing.
and she is changing in a way that feels that way. Wow. So it's just a very, a creepy but really interesting short read.
Yeah, that really caught my eye when it came out.
It is really more about the relationship but it has the backdrop of the scientific experience of a corporation that's not returning her calls anymore. That sort of thing is also in the background. So it's just an interesting, eye-opening read.
Yeah,
neat. Well, I do have one last title that I want to recommend. It's actually a book of poems. It's Monsters Growling in the Background, and it's illustrated by Martin Ontiveros. And really, that's the reason I'm recommending it, is the illustrations, although some of the poems are definitely notable. It's both, you know, a collection of classic and contemporary poems that are kind of scary. But the illustrations, wow, reminiscent. If you are familiar with Duncan Tonatiuh, I think that's how you say his name. He's a Mexican illustrator, or Mexican-American illustrator, maybe. I'm not sure. But, yeah, very, very striking, very colorful. You have to see the opening poem, Halloween Party by Ken Nesbitt. It's just an amazing Dracula image with the bats. You can't see here as you're listening to me out there, audience.
It's fascinating.
But it is awesome. There's also someone by Walter de la Mare is featured in there, and that's got this like hue of orange that is just pretty, pretty intense. And then the one that I really loved, I know I have read Shakespeare's, let's see if I can find it now. I had it. Song of the Witches by Macbeth, or from Macbeth. And I know I've read Macbeth long, long, long ago, but I had no memory of this. Double, double, toil and trouble, fire burn and cauldron bubble, cool it with a baboon's blood. Then the charm is firm and good. And the illustration are these witches that in a weird way kind of reminds me of like fast food or something. I don't know. But yeah, I really like this collection. It's a skinny book, like a picture book, but definitely really interesting poems. So,
you know what it looks like to me? It reminds me of those black velvet posters where you can shine the light and it's kind of fluorescent.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
It looks fluorescent, like you could turn off the lights and that book would glow.
Right.
I think that would also make really cool thick t-shirts.
Yes,
and stuff.
Absolutely.
I could totally see that.
Posters, like, for sure.
Yeah, it looks kind of heavy metal.
Yeah. Great.
Little Martin 1987 Antiveros in that book too.
Yeah.
You know? 80s metal vibe.
Yeah.
Cool, Maddie.
Okay. It's lovely talking with you guys.
Yeah,
always fun.
Okay. Until next episode.
Happy harvest, happy Halloween.
Yes.